Well, if you're watching what seemed to be and were yesterday some exciting football playoff games, you may, those of you in a certain age, have been drawn back to one of the great teams in the history, I think, of professional football, the 1963 Chicago Bears. Chuck Billington, Charles N. Billington more formally, has written a fabulous book called The 1963 Chicago Bears, George Halas and the Road to the NFL Championship. Chuck, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Rick. Thanks so much.
It's just a great book. Let me ask you first. You've written a book about the Cubs before that. You were... It's not as if you live in the past, but you have some experience as a youth with the 63 Bears. What was it about this team that so grabbed you?
Yes, well, I'll tell you, I also, similar to my 1959 White Sox book, I was a young guy in my formative years in 63. I was a try-hard high school quarterback myself that year. And
What high school?
North Park Academy.
Yeah.
And the Bears that year kind of captured the city's imagination because they finally climbed the mountain and beat the Green Bay Packers twice to take the title. And everybody, of course, was saying, oh, this is so wonderful. George Halas is a 68-year-old owner coach, and he won another title after not winning one since 1946.
Yeah.
But, you know, most of the credit for the team and the success goes to a man named George Allen, and also to a certain extent his coach, Jim Dooley. So this was a city that was also starved for championships. The Cubs, of course, lost a seven-game World Series in 45. The Chicago Cardinals, whom few people followed, won a championship in 47 and lost one in 48. The Bears got smeared by the Giants in 56. The White Sox had a great season but ended in disappointment against the Dodgers in 59, and Chicago finally had a championship the very cold December of 1963. Speaking of how cold it was, we're going through quite a cold front now, obviously, in Chicago and the Midwest.
Yeah.
But between December 11th and December 22nd in 1963, the temperature was only above zero on 2 days for a high.
Well, and the great thing is there were no down jackets in those days either.
I mean, right.
One of the great things about your book is fabulous, Chuck, on a number of different levels. It's called The 63 Bears, and it's not – you're really wonderful about being evocative about and vivid about the season itself and the players and the games. But there were so many other things overshadowing, I think, this team. The fact, I saw games, I'm old enough to have seen games at Wrigley Field where the Bears played. You were too, and you bring that up in the early chapters of the book.
Yes.
Remind people, I don't mean to over-romanticize that setting, but it really was something, was it not?
It was a very, very, very wonderful place to watch a pro football game. Like all the old baseball stadiums that had teams were. If you had seats along the third base line of Wrigley Field, and you were lucky enough to be in the first couple rows, you were essentially right at the back of the Bears bench. And the Bears would often talk to the players that were just on the first couple rows. And then if you were on the first base side, you were actually in the end zone, because the end zone, the south end zone of Wrigley Field, as most people know that remember, was not a full end zone. It was not the complete rectangle that we're used to.
Right.
One corner was cut out because of a dugout.
You know, and
they put boards over the dugout to complete a corner of the end zone. Yeah. The Bears, by the way, used that to their advantage when Del Schaffner was wide open for a pass in the end zone, and Davey Witzel, a very cagey defensive back, was guarding him, and everybody said, well, Schaff is going to completely have his day with Witzel because he was an illustrious New York Giants star with the New York media behind him. He's wide open for a pass. Witzel starts yelling, the wall, the wall, look out for the wall. Schaff takes his eyes off the ball. He drops it. suddenly the Giants lose out on a touchdown.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. You know, I know you went out and tried to interview as many of the participants still alive and still, sort of ambulatory. Yeah. What was that like? I know it was difficult to get the sum.
Yes, very difficult to get the sum. Some are very uncommunicative, either because they didn't want to talk about it or because of health reasons. I was very fortunate in having a long and very, very informative conversation with Ronnie Bull.
Mm-hmm.
I also, prior to their passing away, I was fortunate enough to talk with Doug Atkins, the monstrous defensive end in the Hall of Fame, and also Bill Wade, the Bears quarterback. And I also had an engaging meal with Ed Obradovich, talking about the book as well.
Yes, who I see most Sundays here, and I find him a charming. I'm glad I don't play on the Bears now because he would not be friendly to me. But I find him a charming, charming guy. Yeah. And the era, what impresses me so much. I think now even the most ardent fan. It feels kind of remote from the game. I don't know if it's my place to say, but in reading your book, there is such an intimacy to the game and to the heroes. I mean, someone like Rick Caceres, who was a great running back, mm-hmm. was making $20,000 a year, for goodness sake.
$20,000 in 1960 was... a pretty darn good salary, and Caceres lived very well. But I know exactly what you're talking about. The big money in the NFL didn't come until 1963-64.
Because of TV.
$4.6 million TV contract through CBS. Suddenly, almost every team could meet its payroll before it sold its tickets. Because the salaries in the NFL were quite low. The highest paid player in 63 was Jim Brown at $40,000. The second highest was Y.A. Tittle at $36,000. The highest paid player on the Bears in 63, as far as I can determine, was Caceres at $23,000. And the other thing is, this is just the fact that the Bears were kind of slow to come to the party in terms of big revenue.
Yeah.
The Bears were one of the three poorest paying teams in the league, along with Philadelphia and Pittsburgh.
Well, that
most of the Bears' salaries were between $8,000 and $20,000 a year.
Well, one of the other things that's fascinating about your book, and I was old enough to read newspapers at the time, the 1963 Chicago Bears, George Halason, the road to the NFL championship. That road was, and we'll talk about it after a short break, Chuck Billington. That road was shadowed by some serious gambling troubles, was it not?
Yes.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Right. And then I also want to talk. I've always been fascinated with Halas. I've been fascinated with Halas ever since, I saw him on the sidelines and ever then learned that he survived the Eastland disaster because he slept too late to be on the boat. I mean, it's a fascinating, fascinating human being. And I find him in this book sort of a little Shakespearean. So let's, after a short break, Chuck, hang on, and we'll talk about gambling and Halas as a Shakespearean character. So thank you. We'll be right back. My guest on the phone, and this is Rick Kogan, back in the radio business after a reluctant interlude. Chuck Billington is the author of a book called Comiskey Park's Last World Series, The History of the 1959 Chicago White Sox, which was published a few years ago. His new book is the 1963 Chicago Bears, George Halas and the Road to the NFL Championships. They are not merely sort of nostalgia trips. They are very intense and well-researched looks at an era that many, many of us still remember. He brings the games themselves back vividly, but also surrounds these stories of the games and the players with, sort of societal troubles. The it was a revelation to me to understand, Chuck, before the big TV money came into this thing, how big and damaging a deal gambling potentially was to the NFL at the time, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
And, you know, in many ways, the league was not founded on the basis of setting up a gambling mechanism.
Right.
So many of the owners in the 1920s came from, I'll call it the sporting life background, because in those days, there was a certain amount of, it wasn't all dishonor to be a professional gambler.
Right.
The Maras, Tim Mara, who owned the New York Giants, Arthur Rooney, who one day won an incredible $250,000 at a racetrack in the 1930s and then bought the Pittsburgh Steelers for $2,500. Mm-hmm. Dick Richards, who was a car dealer in Detroit, moved the Portsmouth Lions to Detroit to become the Detroit Lions. The really only owners that weren't involved or administrators that weren't involved in gambling was Hallis, who was threatened within an inch of his life, according to some books, by his father if he ever gambled, and also Curly Lambeau, who founded the Green Bay Packers. Many of the other owners were involved in gambling routinely, and there's even, as I cover in the book and is also covered in the McClellan Committee in Congress, investigations into Carol Rosenblum, the owner of the Baltimore Colts, betting not only on his team but also against his team. Yeah. And there's quite a few books and monographs that talk about this as well.
Well, but yours does too, and I find it fascinating. That's one of the things. I mean, you know, I love your writing, and I adore the depth of your research, but you introduce characters such as this a guy named Abe Samuels, a high roller who once admitted to the Chicago American that he bet, and this is in the late 50s and early 60s, $190,000 a year on pro football games. He was also a good friend of Paul Hornung, who got in some trouble for gambling. It could have, the potential was there for gambling to really scar professional football, wasn't it?
Samuels got his hands into the football gaming, as I will respectfully call it, early on. He picked up a very close friendship with Paul Hornung.
Yeah.
Hornung writes about it in his biography while Hornung was still playing at Notre Dame. And he was part owner of the Douglas Lumber Company, and one of its employees in the off season, working as a salesman, was Phil Handler, who was none other than a Chicago Bears coach. The tentacles of the gambling industry had a long, long reach, and including some really colorful characters in Chicago.
Oh, this Zsa-Zsa Yitkovich is something out of a Damon Runyon play, for God's sake.
Yeah. Zsa-Zsa Yitkovich is one of the most, it was probably one of the most fun things I wrote about in the book. This was a guy who was no more than a long before Bleacher Bums,
right,
a Bleacher Bum groupie that used to yell at the other teams and so forth. He was a runner for a high-class gambling operation on LaSalle Street called the Gym Club.
Yeah.
And he was also kind of a football groupie. He would hang around with the Bear quarterback at the time, Ed Brown, and also claimed as a close personal friend, Rick Caceres. Well, this is all the league needed to hear.
Sure.
Because this guy was also one of the debt collectors for the gamblers. And Caceres, believe it or not, was the first person interviewed and had a lie detector test in the whole gambling scandal, which eventually cost Alex Caceres and Paul Hornung their careers for 2 years.
I know. In the minute few time we have left, and again, the title of Chuck's book, his formal title as an author is Charles N. Billington. The 1963 Chicago Bears, George Hallis and the Road to the NFL Championship. Hallis might have assumed the team was sort of, George Allen, who was a defensive genius of the team, was sort of under the illusion that he would eventually become coach, was he not?
Yes. By 1963, he was acting as the team's general manager.
Yeah.
He was working as the team's defensive coordinator, and he was also the head of scouting for college. If you look at the starting lineup of the 63 championship team, I believe it's 14 individuals on that team were selected or traded for by George Allen. Mm. And, of course, he's the same George Allen that brought us Gail Sears and Dick Butkus.
And Dick Butkus in 65, yeah. One of the great drafts in the history of the NFL. What Hellas's reluctance to, I can understand it on some level, Chuck Billington. It's his team. He founded the team. He founded the league. There's something sad and I don't want to say tragic about his reluctance to give up the reins. I got that from your book. Is that the way you feel?
Yes, I agree with you. A lot of people thought after they finally won the title in 63, that a 68-year-old man would bow out, would leave on the top, gracefully go down. But according to David Moranis, who's a great biographer and who wrote a great book on Vince Lombardi, and other books as well, like Jeff Davis's book on Hellas, it's pointed out that Hellas, his white whale, his Moby Dick, was really Vince Lombardi.
Yeah.
Lombardi was a assistant coach who helped the Giants beat the Bears in 56. Lombardi was a younger, mid-40s, 50-year-old whippersnapper coach who had won three titles and wanted to win. And Hellas was insistent on, many people think, on catching up with Lombardi and not letting Lombardi's legacy eclipse his.
Yeah.
The problem is the game, as he was 68 years old, the game had changed so much. There was big money. There were different rules. There were different ways in which you could procure players. There were different ways in which you had to treat players because of the money they could make and the fact that they could go to the American Football League.
Exactly.
You do a
real wonderful job without banging readers on the head about it, that to show that the game passed Hellas by. And I think he is now in some ways considered this old guy who used to coach the Bears when he was so much more than that. And I think you're right. He retired at the end of that season with the championship and let George Allen run things. And who knows? Because except for the 85-86 Super Bowl, this has not been the most well-run organization in the world. Chuck Billington, go ahead.
He was paying George Allen, one more thing, he was paying George Allen $19,000 in 1965, the same year he drafted Butkus and Sears, was acting as the general manager and the defensive coordinator, and the team had gone 9-5. Allen was offered a contract for $48,000 a year, plus a training facility and a house in Los Angeles if he went to coach the Rams. He took the job. George Hellas sued him to honor his contract.
Yeah.
He won in court, but then he dropped the suit, and Allen left, and the Bears were in disarray from 1965, perhaps, shall I say, until 1985, some argument, perhaps.
It's a marvelous book, Chuck Billington, the 1963 Chicago Bears. And it's not just a book about football. It's a book about life and about this city and about big business, which football, sort of the seeds of what football has become. I'm now looking at a television set where everybody walking down the aisle of the stadium in Buffalo makes hundreds of millions of dollars. Chuck, it's a great book. I can't wait for your next one, pal.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much, Rick, and thanks for your support and your time.
It's a terrific book.